At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Hello, everyone. I want to make mention of some of the places during the last couple weeks that our show has been listened to. And I, as you know, I always find this fascinating. So if you're in any of these places, please let us know what speaks to you about the show. So we have regular listeners in a lot of English-speaking places. The, you know, United States, UK, Australia, Canada, and the like. But we also, over the last 2 or 3 weeks, had a lot of listeners in Sweden, Brazil, the Netherlands, and Norway, and Ireland, as well as Chile, the Czech Republic, and Mexico. So I find this all fascinating. So please be in touch. And for today on the show, we have Elle Hardy. She is an Australian-born journalist mostly based in New Orleans. She has covered stories from every continent on Earth, from North Korea to the backwoods of Alabama. Her writing credits include The Guardian, The Times, GQ, Vice, and more. Elle also went on to co-host the podcast series False Prophets. That's P-R-O-F-I-T-S. Love the title. A personal journey into the heart of the Hillsong megachurch. Her first book exposes the Pentecostal agenda, not just saving souls, but also transforming societies and controlling politics. She's currently working on her second book about the Unification Church, also known as the Moonies. You can learn more about Elle and her work at ellehardy.com. Here's Elle now. I am so happy to be speaking with Elle Hardy today. It is an interview that I have definitely been waiting for. There's so many subjects I want to be able to cover, especially surveillance. Also, being able to speak about your podcast and your latest book, Beyond Belief, which is actually the name of one of my favorite Elvis Costello songs, just as an aside, having nothing to do with it, but that's what I think of. Anyway, so it's lovely to have you on. If you don't mind taking a moment, just introduce yourself.
Sure. Well, it's great to be here. My name is Elle Hardy. I am an Australian-born, US-based journalist and author. I mostly write about the religious right and Christian movements in the United States and all around the world.
Okay. So let the listeners know a little bit about what brings you to being interested in this subject and not only just interested in it, but really kind of opening our eyes to things that are happening that are sometimes overt, but mainly covert, that are sort of these movements, these trends that are being introduced to our society without our knowledge to a great degree. So what brings your interest here?
It's quite a long story, so I'll give the short version. I wrote about it initially. I did a story in 2008 that was the genesis of my book on the global Pentecostal movement, but it was about the John School movement, which is quite prominent in the United States and particularly in Texas. I'm not sure which other states are so involved with it now. it's a program for men who are caught soliciting prostitutes for the first time. And it's sort of like getting done for a DUI. So instead of going through a court process, if you plead guilty, you can go to a remediation school, essentially. And Pentecostals have been really heavily involved in this movement. And in Texas, they are running a lot of these schools. Basically, they're very expensive. It's very punitive. These guys, you know, still get perp walked and have to go through a lot of, you know, losing their jobs, having their families break down. So these sorts of things got me very interested in the, I suppose, some of the new networks and the nexus, the public-private partnerships that we're seeing going on in the United States, where the punishment and the restitution is farmed out to church groups from the state. And obviously, as someone who's pretty keen on separation of church and state, I do find that troubling. So that was the genesis of a lot of my work, and then getting to know the global Pentecostal movement and how it's the fastest growing religion in the world really interested me, and getting to see how it looks in different places, from Brazil to Nigeria to Korea. But obviously, as someone who's based in the United States, I do follow things quite closely here. And being an electioneer, having some pretty big issues on the table at the moment, as you can see, there's quite a lot of things going on. And obviously, one of the things that really interests me, I suppose, about the evangelical right in the United States, who I do focus most of my writing on, is that the numbers are certainly crunching right now. We're starting to see the US behave much more like Western European nations, in that it is secularizing. But there certainly is a more and more of a rightward political shift of evangelicals that obviously started in the, you know, in the 70s and even arguably before that. But now I think we're seeing fewer and fewer evangelicals and people who call themselves Christians, they are tended to be more extreme in their politics, more rusted on, feeling very encircled by a liberal secular world around them. And I think that is producing some of these more interesting surveillance programs and, yes, some stuff, as I mentioned before, that I think is probably not great for society as a whole, and is really bleeding the public and the private and the, you know, secular and or religious and governmental spheres that I would think in an ideal world should be kept separate.
Right. Okay. So well said. And, you know, there's so much that I've learned from the guests who have been on the show. And by the time your interview comes out, the guests will have already heard about things like the Seven Mountain Mandate and a lot of the things that are happening where there is this, I can't think of another word except encroachment, right? And that it's sort of, the hope is to kind of permeate every facet of our lives. Without our consent and without our knowledge in most situations, which I find incredibly deceptive and dangerous and disrespectful, especially to people of other traditions like me. But I think also I'm wondering about some of the things that you've uncovered, and I know you would only be able to touch on this for a few moments, but because we have a global audience, when you were saying that you were finding that these movements were slightly different in some other countries, what are some of the differences that you've noticed that are notable?
For example, in Brazil, there are sort of, as we speak, Pentecostals have overtaken Catholics in that country. And it's really happened in a span of 40 years. They've undone 500 years of Catholicism. So it's quite distinctly Brazilian. It's the Pentecostalism is the faith of the working poor there. So it's really based in the favelas. It's very big on health and wealth, so prosperity gospel and faith healing for people who just don't really have a shot at much state or employer medical care. It's very, very mixed race. It's not really led by white people. And it's very authentic. So it's really the most charismatic guy in the favela is often, you know, becoming this church leader, whereas traditionally Catholic priests are sort of dropped in from their education in Europe, and they're seen as very bureaucratic, whereas your Pentecostal preacher is really sort of seen as like a startup guy. So it obviously has those characteristics which are very important to people's lives. And I mean, for example, in Korea, it's much more middle class. Pentecostals help run the Underground Railroad to get people out of the North, out of North Korea, which leads to some interesting discussions about how much they get coerced to find Jesus along the way. And, you know, it's sort of, it's different for everyone, but yeah, some people don't really have a choice. Some people, it takes them years and they've got nothing to read but a Bible. Some people find it's the best way to fit in. And then there's all sorts of problems when a lot of people from the North do get to the South because they speak with a very different accent, because they're smaller, because they just culturally don't fit in. And they really have a lot of problems. And the mega churches do provide them with something of a safety net. But there is an expression called showing your face, where you have to show up to the mega churches every Sunday and sort of say, hey, yeah, we're here. We're those, you know, we're refugees from the North. Your church is blessed with us and you've given us new life. And yeah, you can imagine sort of spiritually and emotionally, that's something that isn't great for already traumatized people.
Certainly not. Yeah, that idea that along the way, people are going to be preached to and or converted, it's so problematic. And it happens so often when people are in those periods of transition or are transitory in some way. A lot of these groups, you know, find themselves in the prison system and hospitals and counseling centers and help, you know, quote unquote, helping people who are having a hard time. But that wasn't what they signed up for. They're just trying to get some freedom and sometimes get ensnared along the way. I have that also. It's a bit problematic in my field with some people who want to be able to work with me, who have an organization where they are trying to save people from situations where they're being controlled, but they have an agenda, you know, and it feels like, you know, out of the frying pan into the fire. And so I try to distance myself from people who have the real answer, you know, for them, whatever that is, according to them. So, right. How interesting. So I'm wondering, you know, there's this part, I want to be able to talk about surveillance. I also want to be able to talk about nuns. And so let's first talk about the nuns, the movement towards the right and what you're noticing.
Sure. So in the United States, as I mentioned earlier, that evangelicals have been moving to the right for quite some time, really since the Reagan election. But Catholics are really starting to move in that direction as well. We've seen quite a number of extremist priests and nuns in the United States effectively be sort of excommunicated from the Catholic Church for various things they've done, usually around Latin Mass and not adhering to certain doctrines laid down by the Pope. And we should say that Pope Francis is seen by a lot of very right-wing Catholics as, I mean, he's an out-and-out socialist, and he's viewed as essentially heretical by some factions of the Church. And that's why at the moment we're seeing this real political split in the Church about things like Latin Mass, because it is, well, it's obviously important to some conservatives, and the more liberal wing of the Church has their reason for not wanting to have Latin Mass anymore. I think it's sort of a proxy for the bigger political split that's going on. And so, yeah, within Catholics in the United States, I think that some of these figures, while they've sort of become almost larger than life and a little bit cartoonish in the way that they sort of become the villains. Most famously, there was a Nuns for Trump movement who aren't actually recognized by the Vatican as ordained nuns, but they would turn up at Trump rallies in 2016 and 2020 and hold up all sorts of signs. And they really are essentially an anti-liberal movement who are very, very opposed to abortion, but also, you know, socialism. they're firmly nailed to the mast that that's what they disagree with. And the recent story I did for Unheard about them was that they are sort of representative of a rightward swing of Catholics in the United States, and particularly within that cohort, we're seeing Hispanic Catholics who have traditionally been far more liberal and far more in the Democrat voting tent are moving to the right as well.
Very interesting. You know, I'm noticing also, you know, with Amy Coney Barrett, there is this, there's a discomfort that a lot of people who I talk to who are in like my former cult member support group, that's every other week, they're very uncomfortable with having someone who was involved in a group that was quite conservative being a Supreme Court justice. And in fact, someone who I spoke with who in the support group, who was a member of the same group where Supreme Court Justice Barrett was actually, her title in the group was handmaid, which is chilling with Handmaid's Tale. But she said that she could, she was familiar with her countenance, with her cadence, with the language she used. It's like she was bringing that group into the Supreme Court justice role and the Supreme Court in general. And just that, what felt like infiltration was really unsettling. And it has been unsettling for a lot of people in a lot of different realms. And so not only is there this worry about infiltration, but just also about being sought out, being found out, just not being safe. And so I want to ask you about surveillance. I want to ask you about what you found out about, because when I read an article about that, I found that so chilling. And so tell me what you found out and what's happening on that front.
Sure. So this is within evangelical circles in the United States, particularly Baptist groups in my research. So there's an app called Bless Every Home. And it is, it's backed by former Southern Baptist Convention leader and also GLU, GLOO, which is a big, they don't like it when I say this. I get emails from their PR people, but they're essentially a Christian data harvesting firm that was, that has been behind a lot of data harvesting programs within church apps. Some suggestions, I think, that they had some connections, with, I think, with Cambridge Analytica and some of that stuff, which really helped the Trump campaign in 2016 and just getting information of people who are, you know, probably with quite a lot of goodwill and, you know, entering their information into apps and entering information of their neighbors and things like that. So basically, it has money and organization behind it. But what they do is they help people track neighborhoods, and you can go down, zoom into house level. And this is for just, you know, traditional door-to-door evangelism in theory, which, look, it's fine. It's a bit annoying. You know, no, people only really want the Amazon deliveries to come to the door and nothing else, right? But obviously the capacity for the ability to track information in this app, also the level of data that they're getting from people, they will say that it's all public information, but that is something of a sleight of hand, because this is often very high-level marketing data that's only available to corporations if they pay. So it gives things like, you know, names when they move to the address, and then it breaks down further. So it uses things, it combines, I think, 10 different data sources. So then you've got census data. So it'll have people's faith and sometimes even things such as their country of origin. And what this app and some of the groups that use it suggests that their users do with it is pull up lists of people. So you can, for example, I found a group called Global Gates who were using the app in the Houston suburbs. And they had a training video that was leaked to me. And they were, yeah, talking about, you know, just drawing up lists through the data repository on this app. And so you'd find, you know, pulling up people of Nigerian heritage or of Muslim faith in the area, and working out how you can go door to door knocking, or you can go and leave them a Bible, or, you know, one suggestion was just have a barbecue to welcome new people to the neighborhood. Again, that's quite a nice neighborly thing to do. But as you were mentioning earlier, when there is an element of coercion that comes after that, it's not the nicest thing. Then there's also some concerns with this app. They suggested you can use the individual notes function in the app. So on a house level, to put notes in, such as, you know, their daughter's recently left for college. And that obviously was quite concerning to me, because if you can put, you know, if you're encouraging people to put information about people's children's coming and going on an individual house level, and that's disturbing in the first instance. And then also that often this data is shared in online groups and it's not secure, so that, you know, I found websites where you can just pull up lists of, you know, they suggest Bosniaks in Chicago or Bukharan Jews in New York. And that leads to, yeah, further problems that people with poor intentions could access this data because it's not secure. I mean, foreign governments. I've been to Bukhara myself, and I know that there is a huge Bukharan Jewish population in the United States because a lot of people fled Uzbekistan fearing pogroms in the 90s. So hostile foreign governments could pull up this information. And they share information of things like, oh, these are the cafes that people of that of that ethnic and religious heritage tend to gather in. So there's all sorts of concerns about, first of all, obtaining this data, secondly, how it's used within the groups, and then thirdly, where it's published on securely online and anyone could access it.
Oh my goodness. Okay, well, yeah, I just got the chills because this is so troubling. So troubling for so many reasons. And if it's not secure data, I mean, it shouldn't be pulled anyway, but if it's not secure, I'm thinking about people who then know that people, whatever age, might be living alone. And then if someone wants to rob a house, if someone is a predator, wants to find out the age of the children in the house, oh my goodness, there's so much wrong with this. And the entitlement also, just to be able to collect data so that you can see these people, as I see it, as prey, which is really quite incredible to me. And my goodness, it's very troubling. And also knowing that you're going to be on a list. I mean, hearing that as a Jewish person is really very difficult.
Yeah, you don't need to know a lot about history to understand why some people would have particular discomfort with being on a list. And again, as I mentioned, yeah, there are websites. I think we chose not to publish the links of those. But yeah, where you can look at, you know, just look up and pull some of these data in various subgroups. And yeah, whatever your views on privacy, there's just a creepiness to it.
There is a creepiness to it. Something I talked about just briefly on the podcast before was in my neighborhood, and because of my home, and I have a mezuzah, which is sort of this prayer that's on the wall and out in front of my house, which signifies for a lot of people a Jewish home. So I get descended upon by a lot of people trying to save me, which is really fun. And they come also on Jewish holidays. So it's like this time with family, and suddenly the doorbell rings and people will talk about how basically I'm not saved. We're incomplete the way we are. We need to be kind of completed Jews, and we need to think about our safety forever, etc. But the whole idea of someone descending on your house already makes you feel unsafe. But I don't know if they have that awareness that is actually what they're doing. But during COVID, I got what I think he thought was a lovely text message on my cell phone from my local Jehovah's Witness representative. I didn't know I had one, and I also didn't know he knew my cell phone number. And he said, normally I would go door to door, but because of COVID, we're trying to be respectful. Thank you. And we want to be able to, you know, share the good word. And here are some Bible passages that I would like you to check out, all from the New Testament, all about sickness and health and healing that God, you know, basically I don't need to wear a mask and I don't need to get any kind of shots. I just need to follow these Bible passages and pray. So I thought, okay, well, that's maybe a one-time thing. It's very intrusive and annoying, but I'll try to see it as he thinks he's being helpful. A week later, I get another text message checking to see if I did my homework. And I've never met this person, but he's worried about my spiritual safety. And that's when I responded. And that's after which he did not get back to me. And I also let him know that I was doing counseling with a lot of former Jehovah's Witnesses. And if he ever wanted to come to me for counseling, he could do that. I think that was the end of our relationship. And it wasn't even to make it the end of our relationship. I really wanted to let him know that if he decides to leave, that I could be a resource for him. But the idea that there are people who I think really are convinced that they are doing this for you and have no sense about what it feels like. I mean, have you found that in the research that you've done, that there is this real, it's either naivete or just an entitled sense that drives it? What do you think it's about?
I think it is, for a lot of people, it comes from a place of genuine faith and genuine belief. And you know, if you are a committed, hardcore Christian, you do believe that you need to help people get saved. And you do believe that, you know, the end times are drawing nearer and we're going to get everyone in the tent. So I think in a lot of cases, it does come from I'd like to give the benefit of the doubt that it comes from a good place. But obviously, you know, as we've sort of talked about, there is that real sense, particularly I think in the modern world, of that it is intrusive having someone knock on your door when you know, unwelcome, and that, you know, most people are aware of the Christian message, and if they want to go to church, they can, and they have plenty of resources online, and they don't need to have this pushed out onto them. And yeah, I think from that sense, it's just sort of a general privacy and kind of just the, you know, the right to be left alone. I think that most people just you know, most people are busy and tired and stressed enough already, and you don't need another thing. And it's silly, but it can be quite a stressful and in some cases distressing thing if people are, as you mentioned, not respecting your holidays when they probably know that you are Jewish and things like that. That it is it is disrespectful, and that as a first principle, we just leave people alone and let them get on with things.
Right, exactly. Well, I also remember in this text saying, well, clearly you know where I live. If you want to continue having a discussion, why don't you give me your home address and I'll bring my family over and we'll talk. And that never happened.
Yeah, on Christmas Day.
Yeah, right, exactly, right. Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, it's right, Easter. Right, but it only goes in one direction, which is the other thing that when people ask me sort of the definition of a cult, one of the definitions, one of the characteristics is that the rules only apply to the followers. They only go in one direction. Well, I found this here too, that he wasn't going to disclose anything about himself, but he didn't mind letting me know that he had found out a lot about me. So now that you've uncovered this and have made it public, what can be done? I mean, now when you know, part of the frustration, I'm sure, is that there are these protections that a lot of these organizations have. And is there anything that can be done to ensure more safety?
Yeah, I mean, look, that is a great question. And I think this is just way bigger than the particular issues that we're speaking about here. I mean, everyone is familiar with scam likely calls coming up how many times a day. At the moment, I'm constantly getting texts about, you know, from unknown numbers, do you want remote work? You know, there's a new scam going on every week. I think, you know, most people like myself with sort of older parents, I'm really worried that they're not going to have the digital literacy to know some of this stuff. So, and also, you know, younger people falling prey to these things. So I think that it's a much bigger privacy and particularly sort of digital privacy issue, and just sort of on a personal opinion level, I think it'd be better dealt with in that way rather than specifically looking at these religious groups. And I mean, just with the American Constitution being the way it is, you probably would have to look at it more holistically. But yeah, I mean, in the immediate term, I don't believe that there's anything, you know, that could be done, for example, to stop an app like Bless Every Home. The data is legal. Like I said, it's commercial. I mean, I think some of this marketing data, which they clearly get, a lot of that stuff is fairly, you know, there's some fairly pernicious stuff with that. I don't know if you ever saw that that article, it might have been 5 or 8 years ago, about how Target knew that this teenage girl was pregnant before her parents did, because of her shopping habits and things like that had changed. And they started sending her specifically targeted marketing for an expectant mother. And her parents got upset, and they sort of wound up, trying to work out why they were getting all this material. And then it turned out that she was pregnant. So when you think about that, and that stuff is legal, right? Is it morally right? I think you and I would argue it's not. And no doubt the girl's parents as well. So yeah, I think this is just part of that, a much wider ecosystem. And I contacted groups who make the app and who use the app for comment. And they said, oh, you know, we're very, very careful about children. We don't want anything, we're not targeting them. You know, we want to be very mindful of those sorts of things. But again, you know, as I mentioned, there was this stuff can just get put online and used by anyone. And you can, you know, create tables filtering people down to very fine granular detail online. And the fact that that can be used by well-intentioned and unwell-intentioned actors is pretty troubling, and much wider privacy repercussions that's probably above my pay grade.
Incredible. I mean, I think about, you know, the ethical guidelines for therapists, and how if we have people who are underage and who are, let's say, pregnant, at what point do they have the right to their privacy, where we should not let their parents know if we think it's going to put them in any kind of danger? And so there's so many other professions that have to follow by what's in the best interest of the person, but not marketing, not actual businesses. That's incredible.
Yeah. And I think that oversight, it's something that I write and think about a lot within church movements, and particularly the Pentecostal charismatic churches that I write about. Part of the reason why they've been so successful, but also found themselves in a lot of controversy, whether it's over sexual abuse allegations or impropriety when it comes to money and things like that, is because there is no oversight, particularly within that branch. I mean, there's a Southern Baptist Convention for Baptists. There's, you know, the Catholic Church hierarchy for Catholics, Pentecostal charismatic non-denominational churches. There is absolutely no oversight. There is little to no educational standards. A lot of the church boards that get put in, for example, you know a lot about Hillsong, is just appointing your mates to the boards, and and everyone gets paid, and we're all looking out for each other, and we're all on a very similar wavelength. And that complete lack of oversight, and you know, obviously, again, with the American Constitution, there's no way that you could have something that you say have in the medical field, sort of a board and people signing up to codes of ethics and having those sorts of things reviewed, but. You know, I think it's certainly something that within a lot of these church movements, I would hope that there becomes more of a movement for that oversight. And particularly when it comes to sexual abuse allegations, we're just seeing almost daily at the moment from quite prominent mega churches down to obviously, you know, very, very small local churches, is that, you know, the thing that people always thought was the Catholic disease for a very long time of clergy that weren't able to marry or engage in sexual activity, we're abusing children. And it's clearly just very much a power and authority thing, because we're seeing it come out constantly in churches now, in evangelical churches. And I am hoping that because it's really a crisis point now, that there might be some ground, some sort of grassroots movement within those churches to have better oversight, because, you know, no, no one likes sexual abuse of kids, right? And it's, for me, that's sort of a, you know, let's drop everything and try and fix the problem. So I think it's a crisis point now, and hopefully maybe it's getting to a tipping point.
Yes. And I wonder also, just going back to your book, when we talk about the Pentecostal church, just for, if you can describe what that is for people sort of listening in who might not have heard other speakers on here talk about that, and how it has certain significant distinctions from other branches. And then I want to talk about how it's taking over and why. Go ahead.
Sure. So there's a lot of different names that get thrown around, so it's a little bit confusing. I tend to use Pentecostal as a broad umbrella. So Pentecostalism is a branch of evangelicalism. So that the born-again movement where you accept Jesus as your Lord and Savior, That's evangelicals. Pentecostals come from that, but Pentecostalism comes from Pentecost in the Bible. So after Jesus was crucified and resurrected, the Holy Spirit descended upon the disciples and gave them 9 gifts. So that is things like speaking in tongues. It is faith healing. It is prophecy. And so Pentecostals really took that particular quite mystical form of the faith on board. And interestingly, it only really got going. There were a lot of undercurrents moving towards that, but the Pentecostal movement as we know it only really got going in 1906 in Los Angeles, when the son of a freed slave from Louisiana did a prayer and fasting ritual to try and get filled with the Holy Spirit. And eventually it came on him and his congregation. So I think the fact that it started out in a very black working class church is quite an interesting part of the Pentecostal story. Most people probably these days tend to think of Pentecostals as, you know, the guys picking up snakes in the Appalachians, or your pretty kind of tame Assemblies of God. But now there are about 700 million Pentecostals worldwide, which is about half to a third of global Christians. And, you know, they're converting 30,000 people a day. The great secret of religious conversion is that you don't tend to convert atheists. You tend to convert people who already believe. So they tend to be converting them from the Catholic faith in Latin America and the Philippines and just other, you know, Anglican evangelical denominations. These days, there have been several waves of the Pentecostal movement. So there was a charismatic wave in the 60s that was a lot of rehabilitated hippies from the Summer of Love, and then a neo-charismatic wave in the 70s and 80s, which was the very corporate megachurch model that we saw applied to a lot of this. So that's why I try to use the expression charismatic Pentecostal, just to try and be as all-encompassing as I can. But really, the thing to look out for with these churches, now they often go under the name of non-denominational. Online, especially, you'll hear a lot of references to the New Apostolic Reformation, which is a very political wing in the United States, which has come out of this movement. So there's all sorts of things going on, but it really is the branch of Christianity that is most interested in the power of the Holy Spirit and in using that power. And I think for your purposes and probably your listeners' purposes, one of the really interesting things that has done was that traditional evangelicals or Christians, you know, will say that they have a direct relationship with God, that he speaks to me. Charismatic Pentecostals will say, well, I get filled with the Holy Spirit, so he speaks through me. And there is, you know, the distinction there is pretty important because obviously a lot of the key people in the charismatic Pentecostal world are prophets. So they're saying that they're getting these direct messages from God, and they're also faith healers. Yeah, as I'm sure you understand, there's a lot of room in that for manipulation and coercion and abuse.
Right. And I think about the Pentecostal church that I'm most familiar with is the Assemblies of God.
Yeah, that's still the largest global denomination, but it's becoming increasingly smaller as other churches just tend to be independent. They tend to appoint their own boards. Assemblies of God is the place where you're most likely to get some form of oversight. For example, Hillsong Church, again, they were under the Assemblies of God banner in Australia. And when it just wasn't working out for them anymore, they just went out on their own. And there's no one to stop you. If your congregation doesn't like it, they'll move with their feet, but they didn't. So yeah, Assemblies of God is probably the best known overarching body. But again, you don't need to have any sort of education, any sort of oversight. You just need followers.
Right. So going back to another definition that people ask me when I try to make a distinction between a healthy religious organization and not, is the lack of oversight, that they don't need to answer to anyone. And there doesn't need to be really an ethical code or even sometimes a legal framework if you're acting independently, which is highly problematic if the leadership wants to get away with things. I'm wondering also about, you know, the views on homosexuality, views on women in general, because I think if it's something that's growing, then it's something that's going to infuse its way into counseling centers, into school curriculum, into a lot of different places that are going to impact people socially. And so what can you tell us about that?
Sure. And so to begin with, just to make clear from what I was saying before, I'm not saying that all of these churches are manipulative or coercive. It's obviously just to, you know, some of the stuff that we're talking about.
Yeah, I'm just saying it has a potential if there isn't oversight, if, you know, if the leadership is wanting to get away with things. It doesn't mean they necessarily do.
Yeah, absolutely. I just want to make clear that we're not painting all churches with this brush. Just talking about, yeah, the problematic end of it. So, yeah, one thing that Pentecostal charismatic churches have always done well from the beginning, as I mentioned, is that they've tended to be far more multiracial and diverse. They let women preach right from the beginning, and they tend to be much more working class. So, I mean, probably the most prominent Pentecostal charismatic in the United States is Paula White Cain, Donald Trump's spiritual advisor, who, you know, sort of came from a very, very impoverished background in Mississippi. She's obviously a woman. Her sort of spiritual father, her spiritual mentor is a Ghanaian priest in Africa. And so that really speaks to a lot of the stuff that interests me, which is the different class and gender-based origins of a lot of the movement and also the transnational networks. But there are certainly a lot of people with some interesting views on women and female empowerment. And I would still say that by and large, the largest amount of people in positions of power and positions of influence, I think, sort of influencers, like we'd think of social media influencers, are very big in this world, tend to be men. And many of the women, the movement is generally fairly conservative. So many of the women who, your Paula White Canes and people like that, who are involved in the movement, the way that I would describe them is being for the sisterhood, but against feminism. So traditional, you know, they see feminism as a liberal secular movement, and, you know, probably rightly so, but they're very, very big on female empowerment. They're very, very big on, you know, sisters helping sisters and having church groups talking about raising your kids and all that kind of stuff. And certainly anecdotally, and I think there is a little bit of data, but it's pretty clear when you go to churches, you know, I've been to these kind of churches in rural Guatemala and big city Lagos in Nigeria. And if there's a dominant demographic in these churches, it is young women with young kids. And often that speaks to a wider societal issue that they're not getting childcare or they're not getting support, or that, you know, men are, their husbands have left, or they're busy working, or they quite often, you know, having problems with drink and gambling and things like that. And that's what people tend to seek help for, often these very earthly problems in these churches.
Right. Very interesting. You know, I've studied social contagion in a lot of these groups, just in terms of how they practice, not just Pentecostal movement, but many. And one of the things I remember when I was teaching a class about this to high school students, we talked about speaking in tongues. While I think some people do feel that they are communing with the spirit, and there are a number of other people who have talked to me who said, I don't know what I was saying, I don't know what I was doing, but everyone else was doing it. And I knew that I was going to get a lot of praise for doing it. And I also didn't want to feel left out. I didn't want to be the only one. And so there is this level of social contagion that is part of some of these traditions. But also, there are a number of people who said, this is not to make fun of it in any way, but I was I had to take a break. I was there all day, or I was there throughout the night, and I just faked it just to be able to get to go and lay down or have lunch or whatever else. There are a number of things that people do, I think, across the board in religious environments where they want to fit in. They want to be a part of what's happening. And when you have these kinds of traditions, I think some people just really want to feel that they have community, and they will do things in order to have community. And I see that being very strong in the Pentecostal movement.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, yeah, we are, you know, we're social creatures, right? And we do like to conform. An interesting slight tangent on that, actually, is I recently interviewed an Australian pastor up in Iowa who's quite involved with the Republican movement. And obviously, Iowa caucus being the first presidential primary to go, they have quite an outsized influence. And something he said to me really stuck with me. He's got a growing Pentecostal charismatic congregation up there. And obviously, you know, I come to these issues as a, you know, secular liberal person. And we were talking about something, I can't remember exactly what. And he just said to me, you know, some people like being told what to do. And it is interesting, I think, sometimes to think about it from that perspective. Again, as I mentioned, you know, so many people are busy working several jobs, you know, trying to juggle working from home and taking care of the kids and that. And if someone's coming to you with a package saying, okay, this is the way to live a good life, and this is what you should be doing to be a moral person, this is what you do to fit in with your local community and your local church, I think for some people, just taking that template and applying it to their life is quite a useful thing to do. And it's not necessarily coercive, but I think, you know, some people really are just looking for that, being told, okay, this is, you know, this is the program. And they're, you know, they find it easier to slot in with it in that way.
It's such a good point. You know, some days when I'm meeting with a lot of different clients, I find, ironically, there is a kind of theme of the day at times where something just comes up over and over. And yesterday, that actually came up with a lot of people who were involved in different kinds of groups or different kinds of relationships where they were told the answer and they were told what to do and they could just hand that over to someone else. And in retrospect, that person or that group was often wrong, but it didn't matter at the time because it felt so nice just to be anchored to this thing, this sort of the formula to follow, right? That gives you a sense of what to do and you don't have to think and you don't have to worry, even if it's wrong.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's like on your daily to-do list. If it's just one less thing that you have to think about and you can just kind of outsource it, you know, some certain moral considerations or when you're going to do these community activities or whatever. And yeah, again, I think, like I mentioned a few times, I think a lot of the issues as well that we are speaking to is, you know, much bigger, much wider societal and political stuff that can't necessarily be solved by always zeroing in on churches alone.
Mm-hmm. So as we're finishing up, is there anything else you want our listeners to know to kind of be mindful of, to watch out for, some of the trends, some of the things that you want people to open their eyes to potentially?
As I mentioned, I think just being aware of these the sort of data harvesting and selling that goes on generally and how that is troubling, I think, for all of our safety, for kids' safety, for minority group safety, that's something that's out there. And I think that, yeah, you know, it would be very much my great hope that it was a much bigger, say, election year issue. Like I mentioned, everyone gets those annoying scam calls all the time, but no one seems to be able to do anything about it. And I think it all is part of this wider ecosystem. But also, yeah, there is a quite an intense right-wing evangelical and, yeah, I suppose wider Christian politicized movement in the United States right now that is increasingly undemocratic. It is very well funded. It is very firmly on one side of politics and goes under, you know, various names and guises. But you know, it all comes in to, you know, some of the other stuff you're talking about with the Supreme Court, with the Federalist Society, with groups like the Heritage Foundation. So there really is a very right-wing ecosystem in the United States that is, yeah, increasingly undemocratic, well-funded, aggressive, at times violent. And yeah, there's some really great books out there from people like Ann Nelson called The Council for National Policy. Her book's called The Shadow Network about the Council for National Policy. And that all those sorts of groups are certainly talking behind the scenes and often they are very shadowy and just is, you know, always good to read more and listen more and find out what's out there and for all of us to be aware of what's going on and keep our eyes open.
It's really good advice. Really good advice. Thank you. Thank you so much, Elle, for your time and all your work. And I hope people check out your book and your podcast and all that you are putting out there for people's benefit and safety. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. Hope that we can do it again.
Lovely. I would love that. One more thing before you go. My goodness, there's so much to cover in this outro that it's hard to just pick one subject to get into. Elle Hardy has a way of covering a lot of really important subjects. And it is really quite amazing how so many people have come on the show recently to talk about how there is such an increase in a religious movement in the United States and around the world that is going against having a democratic society. And I never thought that would happen. You figure that if a country is based on certain principles, it's going to remain that way. I know that's unfortunately naive. I know that hasn't happened in a lot of places around the world where suddenly there was a new regime. But then you can see how much things change. And not only do they change for the men, but usually, more often, they change for the worse for the women. There was a photo I saw years ago of places that had religious leaders take over. And there were pictures of the women dressed in pants, shorts, whatever they wanted to wear. And then however long it was from the time that that picture was taken, whether it was a 10-year time lapse, 15-year, maybe 20-year, all the women looked the same then in the after photos. They were all covered from head to toe. You couldn't see their faces. You couldn't see their bodies. They had no way of showing who they were. In fact, I wonder how frightening it is for children in those situations to just see a sea of cloaks and not know who your mother is, not know who your big sister is, not know who you're supposed to go to for safety. It is something that I am bringing to people's attention as much as I can because it's frightening. It's frightening how much it's happening and how much things are happening behind the scenes. And it was so important to have Elle come on to talk about the surveillance, the data harvesting, and selling of information. One of the things that I want to get back to that she was talking about, and it's a really good and important phrase, is this idea of outsourcing the answer and outsourcing having the answer. We do that a lot in our own lives. We rely on others to have the answer. We rely on our teachers, on our clergy, on our parents, on our big siblings at times, on our bosses, on our partners, if that's part of our relationship. And then there can be a kind of atrophy that sets in where you think that's what you always need to do. You have to defer to the other to know what to do, to know what's right or wrong, to know what the answer is. I was working with a couple many years ago where they were a married couple and they started leaning on someone who was sort of posing as a guru, as a life coach. And they were, as Elle says, outsourcing, having the answer to this other man. And as we find with a lot of people who are more than happy to have the answer for you for everything, they're usually wrong. But they've also set it up so that you're not supposed to ever disagree. And if they guide you inappropriately, or they just flat out misguide you in every way, and then things fall apart in your life, well, that's somehow all back on you. As we've talked about here on the show, it's because you didn't listen carefully enough to what they were saying, or you weren't feeling it in your heart, or whatever the excuses. They can kind of walk away feeling like they don't have to take responsibility for really misguiding you. When the couple came to me after realizing that they had given over so much decision-making power to this coach, and they wanted to be able to get it back. One of the frustrations that this wife had was that her husband wasn't a strong man, as she said. Not quite sure what that means, but in her eyes, he wasn't a strong man. I think it's because he wasn't willing to just come out with an answer when he wasn't absolutely sure it was right. I don't know if that's weak as much as that's being responsible and honest. But there was something about this other man, this coach, where he seemed strong just because he was so absolutely sure. And just because someone's sure still doesn't mean they're right. And just because they give you an answer right away doesn't mean it was right. And so she really wanted to work on helping her husband be a stronger person who she could lean on, who she could rely on to give her the answers. And she wanted him to learn how to assess situations with his critical mind so that he could then decipher things for her and then tell her what the best course of action would be or what the answer was. And while she was talking to me about all the things that she wanted him to be able to work on, some of them are actually not bad things to work on because sometimes you do want the people in your life to approach things with more assurance and more confidence. But it dawned on me as she was sort of trying to craft their couples counseling into having me show him why it's important for him to learn to cull and collect all the data so that he could then have the answer for her, that really she was still outsourcing having the answer. And so I let her know that this was something I would be happy to help with if it's something he wanted to work on. If he wanted to feel a little more confident, a little more sure, and he did a little bit in certain situations. But I said, what about you, to the wife? What about you being the one to have the answer? And it was this moment of silence where she kind of looked down at her feet and was sort of wondering about this idea. It wasn't something that she was raised with. She had actually been raised in a religious environment. And so that was something that was supposed to bypass her and go to the next male in her life. And so I said, how about if we go over these techniques to help your husband, but to see them as being for both of you? These are things that might be good to know how to decipher situations, to know if you're making the right decision. But this is information that is good for both of you. And maybe you want to get in the habit of seeing if you can answer a question for yourself first before you outsource it. And so that began kind of her way of having the torch handed back to her. It was very uncomfortable. Making decisions felt wrong. It felt like she was having an exaggerated sense of ego. All the things she was told would be unseemly for women. But then she kind of started liking it. And it turns out that sometimes she had really good instincts about things. And once she did her research, she could make great educated decisions about things. And that helped her feel quite confident. But she had to push away the talk that she had integrated inside about how this was wrong of her to be so overly confident that she was right and that she probably wouldn't be right even if she thought she was. I mean, there's so much that people walk around with that undercuts their ability to really feel sure and strong and capable. So, Elle, thank you. Thank you for coming on today to talk about all the things that you have been researching, the things that you've uncovered, and some really wonderful ideas that are great takeaways from today's conversation. Take care, everyone. Talk to you next week.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @IndoctrinationPodcast. And for Twitter, find us at @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.
Big news! Wayfair's end of season sale is here. It's Wayfair's Labor Day clearance. Right now, you can score up to 70% off everything home at Wayfair. Plus amazing doorbuster deals and 24-hour surprise flash deals on home finds in every style. This is your last chance to score end of season savings. And it's happening now. Did we mention fast shipping on everything? Don't wait. Head to Wayfair.com today to score up to 70% off now through September 2nd.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.